Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Shellhouse, Judge Smith, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Heidi F. Shellhouse presiding.
Thank you. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. Please be seated. The first case on the calendar this morning is the case of the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy and others versus the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources and PolyMet. The court has been advised that there will be some sharing of oral argument by the respondents, but no sharing by the relators. And so as soon as you are prepared to proceed, you may. Please identify yourselves for us when you reach the podium.
May it please the court. I'm Ann Cohen, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, here representing the conservation organization petitioners. I'd like to start today by touching on what this case is about and what this case is not about. So this case is a declaratory judgment challenge to Minnesota Rules Chapter 6132, DNR's non-ferrous mining rules. The charge is that these rules lack standards and are otherwise unconstitutionally vague. What this case is not about is PolyMet's permit. And I think the proof of this is that the polarities of this litigation could quite easily be reversed. If we are correct, and Chapter 6132 lacks the necessary standards, then a different DNR commissioner could have decided that PolyMet's proposal would create a quote-unquote unacceptable burden on natural resources, unacceptable impact on natural resources, in the words of the rule. And it would be PolyMet or another mining company here today complaining that Chapter 6132 lacks standards and is otherwise vague. So the only real significance of DNR's issuance of a permit to PolyMet in this matter is that it caused it to ripen under the statutory standard in Section 14.44. Now, DNR and PolyMet have spent a lot of time and effort trying to persuade this court not to reach the merits of this matter. They've challenged the timing of this petition, and they've challenged the standing of the petitioners to bring it. So I'd like to touch on the timing and then the standard, and then I'll hopefully get a chance to reach the merits, to talk about the merits with the court. So the timing is dictated by 14.44, and that statute allows a declaratory judgment to be brought originally in this court when a rule or its threatened application interferes with or impairs or threatens to interfere with or impair the legal rights and privileges of the petitioners. So as I read this language, the legislature did not want premature challenges. The legislature wanted some aspect of ripeness and justiciability before people brought these cases before the court. And this is consistent with this court's precedents. When these cases have been brought, this court has, in a number of opinions, either dismissed or cautioned the petitioners that the case has to be ripe. And so in the Minnesota Education Association, this court told the Minnesota Educational Association, wait, your case is not ripe. You have a choice later. You can either, if the rule is applied in the way you fear that it will cause injury or threatened injury to the people you represent, then you can bring a declaratory judgment then, or indeed you can possibly wait until you can bring an as-applied challenge if you find a proper person who the rule is being applied to bring that challenge. So this court's precedents tell us to wait until the case is ripe, and this is what petitioners did here. This rule, as DNR freely admits and is documented in the record, was adopted at a time when no mining projects non-ferrous minerals were anticipated, and that remained the case for a long time. So nobody's interests at the time the rule was first adopted were really threatened by the rule. No one knew how DNR would, you know, it actually be applied until later on. And, you know, then there's a project that came along, and even then it wasn't clear how DNR would actually apply this rule. And indeed, that clarity did not arrive until DNR actually drafted and proposed a permit in which the rubber meets the road with the rules that the permit is based on. And it was only then that petitioners could determine whether their interests were in fact threatened by this proposed application of Chapter 6132. And indeed, the findings of DNR were essential to petitioners making that determination. So this case did not become ripe for a challenge until petitioners were able to determine that their rights were being affected, threatened by the lack of standards in this rule. And then petitioners promptly brought this case. So this case is not early, nor is this case late. DNR and PolyMet advance a variety of theories. PolyMet advances a theory that there is a statute of limitations under Chapter 14. They want to import the statute of limitations from a regular declaratory judgment action under Chapter 555 into Chapter 14. Well, that simply doesn't exist, and this court has never so held that there is a statute of limitations on this type of litigation. You've had cases challenging rules that were 8 years old. You've had, indeed, a case challenged a rule that was adopted in 1973. And this court didn't say, oh, well, we aren't going to deal with this rule because clearly these challenges are beyond the statute of limitation. No. Instead, this court cautioned those plaintiffs, hey, you are early, in fact, because there has been, even though this standard has been on the books since 1973, it hasn't been applied yet in a manner that would threaten the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce members. So the precedents of this court have been, don't be too early, instead of don't be late. Now, DNR has a latches theory. That's an equitable theory. Equity probably doesn't have a place in a case brought under a statutory standard. The real question is, do petitioners have a case that's ripe and justiciable under the statutory standard? So that's really the question, not equity. But besides which, I don't think DNR has established any injury. First of all, it's troubling, and I think the case that we cited establishes that it's improper for an agency to say, well, okay, our rule is unconstitutional or it doesn't meet statutory standards, but that's okay because you waited too long to bring your lawsuit. So you don't get to keep an illegal or unconstitutional rule under equitable principles. The court...
Counsel, and I don't mean to interrupt for my colleagues if there are further questions on this. I'm worried that we're at 7:45 and we haven't gotten to, I think, standing in the merits, and the briefing is excellent in all of these things. So I wonder if we can, I have some questions about standing, and do you mind if we switch to that?
Let's move on. And I was, I'm perfectly ready to do that.
Okay. So on standing, I mean, usually the issue around void for vagueness and substantive due process has to do with the government and a regulated party. We have a different situation here in that your clients are not the regulated parties.
That's correct.
What's the best authority that we can find, that you can find, that tells us that there is standing to raise this particular constitutional claim in the petitioners?
Well, this court has never, in any of its precedents, limited standing in these matters to permittees, which is what DNR and PolyMet are arguing. Only permittees have the rule applied to them. And that's true. Only a permittee would be able to bring an as-applied challenge. But this is not an as-applied challenge. This is a statutory-based challenge. So, for example, in the Mille Lacs sport fishing case, a resort, not a permittee, I mean, the resort doesn't get an angling permit. It was a limit on angling permits. But the resort was allowed to bring a challenge to the rule. And similarly...
So in those cases, though, really wasn't it someone who was sort of representative, at least, of the regulated party who was unhappy with the regulation? I mean, in this case, the regulated party is happy with the permit, and it's someone else who's challenging it, although they would not have an objection, obviously, to the issuance of the permit. Isn't that a difference?
Well, I don't see that in the precedents, Judge Smith. You know, what I see is farming organizations are allowed to challenge. And I think the petitioners are indeed the group that this rule was intended to protect. So if you adopted a rule here that said only permittees can challenge rules, well, that would be a cozy universe indeed between the regulator and the regulated. They could adopt a rule that the legislature plainly intended to protect petitioners, right? Protect the people who own property that might be affected by disorderly mining practices and if reclamation doesn't move forward in the way it should. I mean, it's petitioners whose interests are going to be affected. The mining company and DNR, if the mining company is the only one that can bring a challenge to a rule, then it's a very cozy universe, as I said, for them, because they could adopt a rule that they're both happy with, but the public wouldn't be happy, and the public wouldn't be able to challenge the rule. And I think that would be a very unreasonable and bad precedent indeed.
So you said something that's interesting here with respect to this, and I had a question for the DNR about this, which is you said only a permittee can bring an as-applied challenge. I didn't understand that from the DNR's brief, and I will have a question for the DNR about that. And I want to understand, why would there be a difference in can the petitioners bring an as-applied challenge on vagueness? And you're saying no.
No, because the rule will never, I mean, we are not a permittee. So an as-applied challenge is a defensive mechanism, right? You are accused of loitering, and you say, well, I've been accused of loitering, but the loitering statute, defensively, it's vague. And then there's a judicially created rule that says, and really you're only allowed to challenge that in accordance with your own conduct. So if your own conduct is clearly within the ambit of the statute, we're not going to look at hypotheticals and et cetera. I've seen some erosion in the precedents about that. But
right, because it tends to come up in enforcement as opposed to a permit challenge.
Indeed. And one of the problems with the briefing that we saw from DNR and PolyMet is they willy-nilly mixed in the as-applied challenges with these facial challenges. These facial challenges are indeed a very special aspect of the Administrative Procedures Act. Other states do have them, by the way. I mean, this is a part of the original. This was adopted in the 1950s. It's been around for a long time, and it was in district court before the Court of Appeals was created, and now it's here. So this is a very unique statutory form, allowing people, indeed, I think the legislature, by the plain language of the statute, intended that plaintiffs be able to challenge these rules as vague. So I have a very short time. If you have further questions, nope. I'd be happy. I mean, I'd like to at least touch on the merits.
I would like that.
And explain the importance of having good rules. I mean, we need a good foundation. We want rules that all parties can count on. And even though I think the industry doesn't recognize it, a good rule is good for the industry, it's good for the agency, and it's good for the people who are intended to be protected by the rule. So this should be our goal. And the rule that you have before, I think you can see plainly, DNR had a profound misunderstanding of what a rule needs to include. They felt they could have a rule that would allow them to move the goalposts case by case to say, well, this project has an acceptable impact on natural resources, but this project, no, you know, it isn't acceptable. But it's all within the commissioner's office. It's all subject to the discretion of the commissioner.
Through, you don't think all of it is. I mean, I think you acknowledge that some portions of it are not.
Absolutely. And I do want to touch on that, too, because in their briefs, respondents did raise the question of severance. And I think we didn't have a lot of space left in our brief, and we really couldn't discuss it in a fulsome way. They didn't identify the rules that they would agree were vague and they would like to have severed and then save the rest of the chapter. But indeed, I would like to explain to the court today, make clear that petitioners would be willing to sever the portions of this rule that the court identifies as lacking standards. In particular, I would say the reactive mine waste rule, which is sort of the double whammy, both it uses the word substantially, which is incapable of being enforced, And it also has what I would call the heck of a loophole, which the design trumps everything. So the mining company and DNR agree to a design and no other standards to the extent they exist. The vegetation standard, the blasting standard, you name it. There are some standards that are good standards. They tell us when, they tell us how, and most importantly, they tell us how good. So in the vegetation standard, you know you have to get it done in 5 years and 10 years, and there has to be 90% coverage. This is an enforceable standard. DNR knows how to do it.
Are those prescriptive standards?
In the vegetation standard, it is.
Is that what you're arguing is necessary? I'm trying to understand what performance standards would be okay for you that are non-prescriptive.
We are not arguing that prescriptive standards are necessary. Outcome-based standards are classic rule standards. So I gave the court an example of an MPCA rule that was actually both in one rule. So the MPCA, for example, takes the word substantially when it comes to water infiltration, and the MPCA gives a scientifically stated standard. The permeability must be 10 times, you know, x to the minus 6, you know, blah, blah, blah. I don't know what that means, but it means something to the engineers as a permeability standard. They don't tell the regulated party how to get there, right? That's an outcome-based standard. An outcome-based standard is like the CAFE standard for the fleet fueling efficiency, right? We're not telling the manufacturers of cars how to get there, but we are telling them what the goal is, and that goal, most importantly, does not move from case to case to case. It isn't made up as we go along. And so, no, we are not looking for prescriptive standards. And I see I'm out of time, and I will accept more questions if the court has them.
We'll offer you rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for the Department of Natural Resources.
Counsel, just off the bat, are you asking to move the goalposts?
No. Okay. May it please the court, John Katchen, here on behalf of the Department of Natural Resources. No, we're not asking anyone to move the goalposts. If we want to jump right into the merits, we're not at all concerned about addressing the merits. I think that there's a lot of great case law in Minnesota that supports our view that the rules can be general. They can grant a party, an agency discretion. The Can Manufacturing case, the 1991 Chamber of Commerce case, they all speak to this. And as long as there's a process in place where the regulated entity and the agency can work together, there's an ability for variances, there's an ability to challenge the decisions. This court and the Minnesota Supreme Court has routinely upheld rules that petitioners or other industry groups have challenged as being too vague, granting too much discretion. So, all right. So what I was...
We're still on the merits,
sure.
Or are we going to switch? Okay. So, I mean, what the statute sets up, what the rules are supposed to implement is to be able to identify areas that, with existing technologies, could not be reclaimed.
Right.
Let's leave aside the ones that are just placed off limits, because that's already done. So let's talk about the rest of the state that's not off limits by the rule.
Okay.
What are the... Explain to me how the rules set a standard for determining, or if they don't set a standard, why that's okay, for determining that with existing technology, it cannot be reclaimed. The area could not be reclaimed with mining.
Sure.
What rules would you point to specifically to tell us that?
6132-2000, but I'll get to that in a second. I think we need to take a step back.
Okay.
Because there's two arguments here. One is a procedural due process argument under the vagueness doctrine. And that to survive...
Substantive, maybe, due process. I'm not sure what I think that's...
Yeah, well...
In any event.
Yeah, the procedural... Or if it's substantive, then it's an arbitrary and capricious standard, and we get a lot of deference and the wisdom of the rules and whether or not the rules are have a rational basis. But on the procedural due process point, all we need to show, putting aside standing for a moment, all we need to show is that there's a plausible application of the rules, that they have some meaning. And if you look at the record and our briefs, during the rulemaking record, the environmental groups, including MCA, commented on the rules. They clearly had meaning. They understood what the rules required. Throughout the permanent environmental review process and permitting process, they explained how they thought DNR should interpret the rules. And so we've cleared this very low threshold that we need to overcome in the vagueness standards, that there's just a plausible, there's an a meaningful application of the rules, and it doesn't have to be the best or optimal. It just has to be anyone can decipher. And the NP case, the can manufacturing case, the 1991 Chamber of Commerce case, they all state that the threshold to overcome within this context is, can anyone understand the rules? And clearly, since 1990, 91, 92, there are comments on the rulemaking record, the rules itself, and then throughout the environmental review process, Exhibit 8 in our motion to dismiss, which I believe is before this court, is their petition for a contested case hearing. It's loaded with references to the rules, how the rules have standards, and why DNR needs to modify the project before it issues a permit to mine. And then last...
standard for saying no, you cannot mine here. Not just modify the project to achieve it,
sure.
but that it's beyond reclamation. It will be beyond reclamation.
Okay, so that's a different test, whether or not we've exceeded the statutory authority. And in 9347 subdivision 3, it says that DNR needs to develop a process. It doesn't say standards. A process to identify areas that cannot be reclaimed with existing technologies. And if you walk through, and I think our brief goes through this, if you look at 6132-2000, it identifies the areas that cannot be reclaimed, and so therefore are off limits. It then it identifies other areas where there can't be service disturbances. And then it sets up, through the permitting process, I think 1300 and 0300, a process that the commissioner works with the regulated entities and allows groups like MCA and others to come in and work with the agency on identifying areas that shouldn't be reclaimed or cannot reclaimed. And then if a party disagrees with our determination, like MCA did and others, they can file a writ of certiorari with this court, and they did on Friday, filed briefs addressing these very issues.
And then I think what they argued, though, is there's no metric to decide that it could or could not be reclaimed.
Right.
Without that metric, what's the challenge based on? So what would you say, what would you point to say, no, there's enough of a metric there to make it?
Well, there's no requirement in any Minnesota case law that they've identified that there needs to be a metric. So they cite INRI-NP as a case that supports their position. In that case was an attorney misconduct. And the standard there was it prohibited the attorney from engaging in conduct that is prejudicial to the administration of justice. There's no numeric standards. It's pretty open-ended. And the court easily dismissed it as not a problem. It complies with constitutional requirements and statutory requirements. The other case, and you were on this panel, Judge Smith, was Water in Motion, which is a 2016 case. And the court acknowledged when you're regulating a highly complex issue, industry that has site-specific determinations, you can't have numeric standards. It's very difficult. And there's numerous cases, federal cases and a state of Minnesota case that we've cited, that within the mining industry, the legislature understood that because the regulation is site-specific, you don't have a single site, you don't have a one-size-fits-all mine. You have a complex industry with many different challenges, wetlands, or a whole host of issues that the agency needs to consider. So this court has recognized over and over again, including in the can manufacturing case, when you're dealing with complex industries, it's fine to have more general rules that grant an agency discretion, as long as there's a process in place where the regulated entity and others can participate in the permitting process and then ask for variances or challenge those decisions. And that's exactly what we have here. That's exactly what the Minnesota Supreme Court held in can manufacturing. There was the 1991 Chamber of Commerce case was dealing with rules that were site-specific. There was no set standards, and the court didn't have a problem with that. They said it was fine.
So when you say there's no set standards, but I think your brief argues there are performance standards, which there you are, call outcome standards. I'm just trying to make sure.
Yeah, there's a lot of semantics. I think it's because they do challenge, or at least we thought they were challenging the entire chapter of 6132, and so there are specific performance standards in certain rules. Other areas, it's a bit more open-ended, like in a lot of other regulations that DNR and a whole host of other agencies have promulgated. And so it really, part of the
absence of a performance standard and those other ones require, equate to it being too vague or invalid.
No, well, again, the vagueness.
Or invalid, I'll just.
Right, well, it depends on what the specific challenge is. But at the heart of this case is the Mineland Reclamation Act. And did the legislature grant the agency broad discretion, broad authority to determine where mining should occur, what the rules should look like. And yes, if you look, go through 9347 subdivision 1, subdivision 2, extremely broad authority was granted to the agency to determine where should mining occur, when should occur. It listed, I think, 10 considerations in subdivision 2 of 9347, listing what the agency needed to consider when it was issuing rules. And then if you turn to 9041, it grants the agency extremely broad authority when it's regulating the mining industry. So one of the issues that they raise in their brief is the closure. There's no set standards on closure. Well, their issue should be with the legislature, because in 9341, it says the commissioner determines the term. Similarly, with financial assurances in 49, it says it's financial assurances are it's up to the whether or not the commissioner determines that they're sufficient. So the statute itself vested the agency with extremely broad authority to determine what type of rules to put in place. And the rulemaking record is unbelievable here. It took decades for DNR to put together these rules. It had numerous workshops, groups. MCA participated in the rulemaking record. They and a whole host of other industry groups and environmental groups and federal agencies, state agencies. DNR went to, I think, 6 different mining jurisdictions to assess what's the best type of mining rules. And the SONAR gets into this. The amicus brief that was filed by Mining Minnesota does a fantastic job of explaining the background here and why rules need to have general applicability. And there are rules that are specific and have prescriptive standards or performance standards. But on the whole, since there's no one-size-fits-all mine, there's no problem in having general rules. And again, all we need to do right now is to overcome they have a very heavy burden to show that there's no applicability, no meaning. The rules are completely indeterminate. And their own filings before the agency and before this court just last Friday explained on the reactive mine waste. That's one rule that she wants struck down. She said they're standardless. They go on at length in their brief for why DNR failed to comply with the reactive mine waste rules. You can't have it both ways. They're talking out of both sides of their mouth. And again, we don't need to show that these are the best rules, that they're perfect. All we need to show is that there's one way in which you can read the rules in which there's some meaning granted to them. And they have conclusively established that the rules have standards and meaning. Otherwise, they wouldn't be filing in the brief saying that we didn't meet the standards that they now say don't exist.
I have a standard question.
Okay, sure.
Is it DNR's position that these petitioners could bring an as-applied constitutional challenge?
They are, and they can.
And they can. Why is there any difference in standing with respect to an as-applied constitutional challenge and a facial constitutional challenge? Why should that be different?
There's two different standing arguments, and at times they get conflated in the as-applied. So starting with 1444, it says you have to have a rule that directly affects you. That's what this court has said repeatedly. It's the rule as applied would have a direct impact on a legal right or interest. The rule here doesn't have any direct impact on them. They've their own affidavits and declarations, and I encourage you to read them. It's all about the Polymet mine. So it's DNR applying the rules to the mine, and then they're concerned about what might happen with operations at the mine. It's one step removed. The common thread throughout all of the cases in standing in the 1444 world is that there is an entity, and it doesn't have to be a regulated entity. We never said, by the way, that only regulated parties can challenge. It's only parties that have a direct stake or a legal interest that's directly impacted. Now, switching over real quick to the there's a different standard if you're bringing a vagueness challenge under the due process clause, which is what they're doing. And there is no case anywhere that it always applies to regulated entities because it's rooted in due process. So
let's imagine if we could a regulation that says, a rule that says, and
I'm out of time. But
is that all right,
Presiding
Judge?
Go ahead.
Thank you. If there is a rule that says the commissioner shall exercise unfettered discretion and grant permits at her whim. Okay, so we clearly a regulated party could challenge that facially, right? There would be no issue with standing.
Said a regulated party.
Exactly. A regulated party could challenge and say, oh, that's void for vagueness, and they'd be standing, and they might, in fact, win that if it's that. But an unregulated party who would be affected if a permit issues could never challenge that.
Not under 1444.
Is that right?
No. Not under 1444. They're bringing, they've incorporated into their briefing, I believe, that they filed last Friday, a vagueness challenge. They said, well, if DNR has a discretion to do what it did, then the rules are vague. Or they bring constitutional arguments, if I recall, in their, or maybe I'm read three different briefs, and I can't remember which party raised it, but they did bring constitutional challenges in their in the as-applies context. The other...
That would be okay.
Yeah, and that's fine. One last point. So the other, this court, the Minnesota Supreme Court in March in the Olson decision, we cite this in our brief, and again in the canned manufacturing decision and then in the Chamber of Commerce decision, said that the void for vagueness under the Due Process Clause really shouldn't be brought as a facial pre-enforcement challenge. It's best brought because there's just too much unknown. You need to see how the rules are applied to determine whether or not it violates the void for vagueness doctrine.
You should wrap up.
I'm finished. Thank you.
Counsel for PolyMet.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Jay Johnson here for PolyMet. I'd like to begin with this question about standards that Judge Smith raised a few minutes ago. Petitioners in their reply brief on page 18 say somehow PolyMet conceded that the Mine Land Reclamation Act requires standards. On page 26 of PolyMet's brief, we clearly say that the statute requires no such thing. The term standards doesn't even appear in the Mine Land Reclamation Act. So their argument is that DNR has exceeded its statutory authority by not imposing specific standards, even though the statute never even uses that term once. And as read as a whole, the statute, as Mr. Katchen was explaining, gives DNR sweeping and broad authority to implement whatever rules it chooses to protect the environment and to promote mining. Now, the question Judge Smith specifically asked was, okay, well, what's the metric if there's an as-applied challenge? What's the metric? The metric is science. The metric is 14 years of detailed site-specific studies, in this case, that they are challenging in three separate challenges to the petition, or to the permit to mine, to dam safety challenges. That's where this case is supposed to be decided, whether PolyMet's project is violating the standards that are in the rules. The rules themselves are not vague. They're not standardless. They're not supposed to be required to have standards, and they've got a huge burden to prove that.
I think you said the question is whether they're violating the standards, but then you also said there need be no standards. Are there standards?
The rules. The rules are the rules. They have various different requirements, and they give DNR discretion. They're supposed to. I'd like to just read directly from this Can Manufacturers Institute case. This is on page 423, and DNR cites this extensively in its brief. The court says, we are impressed by the need for flexibility in the review process for packages in this case. Different packages might present different kinds of problems, and it would be unwise to require that the same weight be attached to each factor each time a different package is reviewed. 1,000 times more when you're talking about the complexities of a mine. DNR is supposed to have flexibility, and that's what the statute gives it. Turning briefly to a statement that MCA made right at the outset about timing, because I think this case is untimely filed. They said if you reverse the polarities and PolyMet got denied a permit, then it would want to file a 1444 challenge. No, it would file a petition for certiorari, an as-applied challenge. If PolyMet had wanted to challenge the rules, it would have had to do that when the rules were threatened to be applied. And that was, if in PolyMet's situation, either when the rules were first issued or at the very latest in 2005 when there was an environmental assessment worksheet that mentioned application of the rules 20 times. If they haven't challenged within 6 years of that, they've missed the window for threatened application of the rules. My time's up, but I'm happy to answer any more questions.
Questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Um, Your Honor, I'd first like to very briefly touch on the can manufacturing case, which petitioners have mentioned time and time again. I think it's extremely important for this court, and I'm reading right from the decision, that the regulations promulgated under the act in which MPCA was acting did not have the force and effect of law. This is a very strange statute where PCA was sort of adopting advisory rules, and then the legislature actually had to adopt those rules. So I don't think you can look at can manufacturing for a lot of guidance as to how to handle this particular case. So we've heard a lot, I think, of frankly improper argument about what's going on in the cases involving PolyMet's permit. Obviously, you have to argue things in the alternative, and we did, and we mentioned the declaratory judgment in those cases. But I must reaffirm, this case is decided on the rulemaking record under 1444 and 1445. It is not about PolyMet's permit. And petitioners never saw the actual application of this rule in a permit because DNR chose not to develop that permit during environmental review. So the first time we actually saw the application of this chapter, rubber meeting the road, was when DNR first promulgated what it called a permit. So clearly, you can have standards for complicated environmental projects. So we've cited this court to the MPCA's landfill rules. Landfills have a lot in common with mines. You have a waste stream coming in. You have a basin. It's called a landfill. It has a liner. It has to be finished at some point. It gets a cap. You have to manage water, et cetera, et cetera. And the PCA, in a 1988 rule, adopted standards that can actually be enforced. And this court has not seen.
A permitting process as well?
It also has a permitting process. And there is a key distinction between what DNR has and what PCA has, in that PCA, yes, maybe you can salvage a bad rule with a good process, but PCA allows any party to bring a contested case hearing. And the environmental petitioners who participated in this rulemaking, I've cited the court to many, many statements, both from industry and from environmental petitioners saying, gee, this rule is vague, we can't enforce it, it's going to be continued confrontation and bitterness, there was this prophecy about what was going to happen, but the environmental petitioners were satisfied at that time because the rule allowed them to bring a contested case hearing. No more. In 2017, mining interests went to the legislature and took away the right that petitioners had under DNR's rule to bring a contested case hearing. And so the protections that PolyMet and DNR are citing this court to, illusory, untrue, misleading, there is no longer a formal right to actually contest.
Is a contested case right, though, different? I mean, isn't that a different question from the permitting process that creates a record that then can be challenged in a contested, or on, well, is it cert review? I'm sorry.
DNR controls the record, right, and it makes its decision. And the only way you get to really add your challenge their experts and bring your experts forward and really add the things into the record and have a neutral arbiter making that decision is through the contested case process. That's a very important right, and was taken away in 2017. Legislative overreach, perhaps, well, comes home to harm you in this matter because you cannot any longer cite to the process that was in the rule as salvaging the issues here. So the petitioners only have this path. If the rule is vague, really this is the path under 1444 and 1445 that's open to petitioners to actually challenge this rule. So I'm getting very short of time here, and I'd like to just remind the court of some of the very basic things here. I mean, a good rule is good for everybody. Good fences make good neighbors. Everybody knows whether a project can be permitted or not. It would speed environmental review. It would speed permitting. It would take a lot of issues off the table if DNR would go back and adopt competent rules instead of rules, frankly, that say things like adversely impact natural resources means an unacceptable level of impact on the natural resources as determined by the commissioner. Can this court enforce that? The closure rule. Within 3 years after the start of the closure of basins, or within a longer period if approved by the commissioner. Can this court enforce that? Can anybody change that outcome? The siting standard. Mining shall be allowed only if there will be either no adverse impacts on the natural resources or provisions acceptable to the commissioner are proposed to either mitigate adverse effects, et cetera, et cetera. Can this court enforce that rule? So we need competent standards. They can be performance standards. They can be prescription standards. Outcome-based does not mean you get to decide case by case by case. I think there was some profound misunderstanding of administrative law principles at the time the rule was adopted. So vague rules invite the arbitrary exercise of power. Political pressure can be brought to bear, and then you're going to have a permit that issues. And if this court cannot look at rule standards that are enforceable and clear, then arbitrary power will rule. And so a vague rule is a bad rule, and I ask that this court find that the provisions identified by petitioners are in fact vague and unenforceable, and DNR needs to fix them. Thank you.
Thank you. The matter has been well argued, and it is taken under advisement.